Welcome everyone to the last day of this great time of fellowship and worship and intellectual and spiritual stretching. It is my pleasure to introduce our next plenary speaker, Dr. James Peterson. Many of us here already know Jim as the editor-in-chief of our journal, Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith, or perhaps as president of the Canadian Scientific and Christian Affiliation. But believe it or not, Jim has a life beyond those roles. He has been a clinical and research fellow in genetics and has written two books dealing with theology or ethics of genetic modification and genetic intervention technologies, one called Genetic Turning Points and another Changing Human Nature. He is currently professor of Christian ethics at Roanoke College and professor at the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. Today, he's going to share his thoughts on the emerging new genetic technology, CRISPR technology of genetic modification. So please join me in welcoming Dr. James Peterson.
It'll take just a moment to make all the connections, so if you'd like to stretch or make a break for it, this would be the time.
Can you adjust the lights in the room? I can't really see on the
Looks like we're up.
Okay.
All right, is everyone able to hear me if I speak about this level? Is this good, especially in the back? Just give me a wave if it's, oh, I like that, thank you. Okay. Thank you, Keith, for that warm welcome. I appreciate that. I've been asked to talk today about clustered, regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, but maybe we'll just call it CRISPR for short. CRISPR is a precisely accurate, scalable tool to edit DNA, the instructions for all of life as we know it. It's widely available and relatively inexpensive. In fact, this ad came in my email this morning from a company called Synthego. Free modified synthetic sgRNA for CRISPR. Up to 3 genome editing targets, simply provide your target sequences, arrives ready for transfection. It's a limited time offer. All right, so the commercial world has met CRISPR as well, and part of what's so remarkable about CRISPR is that it's so relatively inexpensive compared to other kinds of ways of intervening genetically. And that's also part of why it's multiplying so quickly. Every once in a while, we come across a technology that triggers all kinds of applications, and this is one that's doing it. Here is an announcement I just excerpt from last Wednesday, June 26th, from the MIT Technology Review. The first known attempt at creating genetically modified human embryos in the United States has been carried out by a team of researchers in Portland, Oregon. MIT Technology Review has learned. The effort, led by Shikrat Mitalipov of Oregon Health and Science University, involved changing the DNA of a large number of one-cell embryos with the gene editing technique CRISPR. according to people familiar with the scientific results. So you can go ahead and read that for yourself to see more detail, but I'm just giving you an example that the technology is being applied so widely and so quickly. Keith kindly recommended, or actually didn't recommend, but at least cited, I appreciate, 16 years ago, my book, Genetic Turning Points. At that point, I described three waves of coming innovations and challenges in genetics. The first wave, of course, was genetic testing. It's much easier to read the genes than it is to change them. So an example would be the 2003 completion of the Human Genome Project, led by our own Francis Collins. The second wave I would describe, or did at that time, was pharmacogenomics, using genetic testing to see what's happening in a particular patient and then customizing medicine or pharmaceuticals to their care. The earliest example of this that was widespread, remarkably, in 1982, we already had Humulin, which was human insulin that had never been in a human body. It was manufactured in genetically altered bacteria. So instead of having porcine insulin, if you were diabetic and needed to inject insulin, we could literally make human insulin by commandeering bacterial machinery. Much closer match, worked beautifully, and to this day, that's in various forms, continues to be where we get insulin, from genetically altered bacteria. The third wave, which at the time people castigated me as being Buck Rogers, was what I called genetic microsurgery or genetic editing. What would we do if we came to the point where we could actually make choices and very directly, specifically change human DNA? Well, we eventually developed some rather clumsy techniques. I mean, they're elegant in their own right, but expensive and slow and not terribly exact, such as zinc fingers and talons. But what's so different now is having quick, inexpensive, and accurate on-target interventions through CRISPR-Cas9. Now, we could already see when it started to become possible to alter DNA that there was the risk of what if you altered in a way that was harmful and it got loose and multiplied. And so early on in 1975, there was a conference at a California state park called Asilomar of people who knew how to do the technique, and they were agreeing together on how to do it safely. The concern was that otherwise modifying a life form that might become lethal and slip out and multiply, that it could be devastating. So at Asilomar, guidelines were agreed to by the people involved, and this became routine. This particular sign about the Asilomar guidelines, if you can read closely, this was posted in 2008, so these kept being posted and were standard and routine in labs, about containment essential, must match the risk, use of biological barriers, physical containment, good microbial practices and training, remember, above all, only you can prevent gray goo. So never release nanobot assemblies without replication limiting code. So these guidelines seem to suffice and work quite well, literally for decades. The change with CRISPR is the application and the wide use that we have to think about it much more carefully again. If you're not familiar with CRISPR, we won't have time to go through that in detail here. The short story is that it has always existed in bacteria. It's a bacterial defense against viruses. When a virus injects its DNA into a bacterial cell, CRISPR was the way the bacterial cell defended itself, by recognizing that DNA and cutting it up so that it couldn't take over. What was so remarkable just a few years ago was realizing how that mechanism worked and that we could commandeer it. And if you would like to see a short TED talk on how that was done, Jennifer Doudna was central in that development, and she'll tell you straight out herself. All right, so now that that's available, what are some of the things we need to think about? The leading scientists gathered in Washington, D.C., in a meeting that was sponsored by the Chinese Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society out of the UK, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and the U.S. National Academy of Medicine. And the idea was to see if we could agree together, as with Asilomar 1, on guidelines for how to use this new technology. The meeting was in specific sponsored and held at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. So you probably remember, in this group you would, I bet, the National Academy of Sciences were founded by Abraham Lincoln. They were given a prominent place there on the National Mall. They're right between the Department of State and the Vietnam War Memorial. The Federal Reserve Board is next door, the White House three blocks away, so very much in the center of action. Here's as you approach. Inside, it is this gorgeous Byzantine mosaic, polished marble, high ceilings, and of course, state-of-the-art conference facilities for a truly international conference. We were opened by David Baltimore, the Nobel Prize winner and president of Caltech. People gathered from all over the world. Pay no attention to that man over in the right-hand corner. As with any professional meeting, you see old friendships renewed. That's George Daly, laughing geneticist from Boston Children's Hospital. That's Jennifer Doudna, one of the key discoverers of the technology in the middle. David Baltimore again. People get to meet each other that they've known by name or by email, as often happens here, and then get to meet in person, which is always great fun. And of course, the biggest or most important business happens in the hallways, in the conversation. We were cooped up together for 3 days, from 7 in the morning till 7 p.m. They brought in food, and the conversation was intense. Some of you will recognize that's Rudy Janisch on the right, the geneticist from MIT, who spoke at our annual meeting at Calvin some years ago. Let's see, the person whose back you're facing, that's Phil Campbell, the editor of the science journal Nature. So really an interesting group of people to talk with. And meetings continued after Washington, April 29th in Paris, back to Washington July 12th, then various subgroups. The kinds of questions that were being discussed, I'll give you just some examples. Should CRISPR be used only to heal a patient presenting for treatment, or should we also treat for their future children? In other words, if you can save the patient in front of you, if you can do it in a way that it doesn't pass on to their kids, should you help them as well? Should gene editing only be used to cure disease, but not to enhance desired physical traits? What are desirable traits? Is it better to live longer? Would it be fair for some people to buy better genes than others can afford? Does editing someone's genes make them less of a person or more a product of our manufacturer? Do we have a right or obligation to make such choices for our children and future generations? Theologically, is such playing God, or is it fulfilling a God-given calling? And who decides? So it's not surprising the group could look pretty pensive at times. I'll mention that fellow in the foreground, that's Fola Essen, the president of the Nigerian Academy of Sciences. So again, this was truly a global discussion in a relatively small group. We did manage to put together a communique. That's the primary drafting committee that was discussed by all. It was released on December 3rd of 2015. The story and the communique were picked up in all the major networks, the national newspapers, such as The Post, The Times, but most people didn't notice. Do you recognize that date, December 3rd, 2015? The day before was the San Bernardino massacre. And so you can imagine on December 3rd, it was the press coverage was still 24/7, trying to figure out what happened and what to make of that horrific experience. So it really tended to drown out what was noted publicly, but not necessarily by most people. So it's a fairly short release. And let's take just a moment to see what kind of a consensus was built in that particular group. The text is in white, and I've put in gold some things I want you to notice. So the gold was not in the original text. Scientific advances in molecular biology have produced remarkable progress in medicine. The gathered scientists wanted to remind people that what they're doing has been very helpful and important, and to have it in that context, that this is the kind of work that has relieved us of polio and so many other diseases, that medical research matters and is important. And to remind us right at the beginning that the scientific community has consistently recognized its responsibility. It's not mad scientists run amok. People are thinking about what's the best and right use of this technology. Next, it goes on to say that gene editing is a much higher accuracy and efficiency than ever before possible. That's part of what's bringing this group together and why it needs to be discussed. And by the way, why are we meeting in Washington? Remember, Washington has two primary points of leverage, money and regulation. And so the people at this meeting, I really had a sense that there was great sincerity, that they were trying to figure it out. They wanted to do the right thing. But also there's a tremendous motivation that they wanted to emphasize that they were being responsible. The government didn't have to pass laws that would cramp or get in the way of the research. And that you should keep the funding coming. All right, so the document goes on to say that intensive basic and preclinical research is clearly needed. That CRISPR is such a powerful technology for just better understanding how life works, and that that has all kinds of implications simply as a research tool, and that that needs to continue and will be very beneficial. Second, that as far as clinical use, proposed clinical uses are intended to affect only the individual who receives them. This is sometimes with the word somatic. Somatic treatment is you're only treating the presenting patient. So the person who's in the room that has a particular condition, that's the only one you're treating at that point. But every word counts. Do you notice in the gold there? Proposed clinical uses are intended to affect only the individual who receives them. So what are they leaving room for there? It's very intentional. That you might very well be treating the patient in front of you, realizing that there will be inherited effects. But that's not your intention. That's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to help the person in front of you. We deal with this all the time in medical care, right? The first widespread genetic test that became state law, standard of care, was testing for PKU. It's where the baby wasn't able to process a particular chemical that occurs naturally in food. And so we have no cure for it. But if you can test and know that a child has the condition and then change its diet, only give it food that doesn't have phenylalanine in it, the child can live a perfectly normal life. If you don't do that, the child will quickly have arrested mental development and remain an infant for as long as it does survive. It's a dramatic difference. You can't cure it, but you can avoid it by changing diet. So that's standard of care. You don't ask parents if they're going to have the heel stick and test for that. That's just automatically tested by every state in the United States. And the list is now expanded. Most states test for about 20 to 30 other conditions with that blood spot at birth. Okay. We've been doing that now for decades. And the number of children being born with PKU is going up. And of course, why would that be? Well, it used to be that if they had the condition, tragically, their development was arrested as an infant. Now they lead perfectly normal lives, including growing up and having kids. Now that's an inherited germline effect, but it was coming from a somatic treatment. So distinguishing between somatic and germline is often very difficult, but at least at this point they were saying, we believe it's appropriate to begin with the patient who's there before us. Okay. The third major statement was that they realized that germline editing, deliberately affecting future generation, posed many more important issues that needed to be thought through. And not being able to do that in just 3 days, they acknowledged it would be irresponsible to proceed without further study and agreement about what would be the best and appropriate use. So do you notice the way they phrase it? It would be irresponsible to proceed with any clinical use of germline editing until there's been more discussion, agreement, and societal consensus. Their expectation, I think, of the group was that eventually there will be. And that's why you use the word until. Until down there below in gold, as scientific knowledge advances and societal views evolve, the clinical use of germline editing should be revisited. So should keep reconsidering to what degree and in what way it might be appropriate. So then that leads to point number four, the need for an ongoing forum. That there should be discussions around the globe, because this affects everybody who has DNA or cares about someone who does. So it should be around the globe, and it should be inclusive. Actually, it was really last minute that in discussion we managed to get two words added in that last sentence. You see that long list: biomedical scientists, social scientists, ethicists, healthcare providers, patients and their families, people with disabilities, policymakers, regulators, research funders. There was some debate, but we got faith leaders inserted, okay, that's part of what's out there too. Public interest advocates, industry representatives, and members of the general public. Okay. At this point, I could continue the conversation about the ethics involved without directly referring to Christian faith. And that's often settings where that's what you need to do. And there's a lot that you can get done on that basis. But this is a group that's particularly interested and engaged, as am I, in a Christian perspective. And so I'd like to set out some ideas and some things to consider about how we might think about this Christianly. And if you want to go back and see the final 300-page report after a year of discussion, that's the location. It's available in print for $68, or you can download it for free or search it for free. So that's where you go if you'd like to see in much more detail what was resolved. Okay, so I'm going to switch here. So some ideas thinking from specifically a Christian perspective. Okay. God has designed nature to be constantly changing. At 8:32 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, May 18th, 1980, this particular 10,000-foot mountain in the Cascade Range exploded. You recognize it. About 425,000 tons of rock and ash roared east parallel to the ground at 425 miles an hour. Within 15 minutes, 54,000 acres of pine trees were open plain. A mile-long lake appeared that remains to this day. A river shifted course and destination. Just in the space of a few minutes. So what mountain is that, of course? St. Helens. Okay, so some of you probably have hiked it or been near it. Here's just an example, one section of the tens of square miles of blowdown. For scale, if you look down in the lower right-hand corner, you can see two people standing there, if that helps. All right. It's even hard to spot them, isn't it? Just tiny in that picture. Nature, as we experience it, is constantly changing, sometimes rhythmically, sometimes in particular directions. Quite frankly, not many of us live on a tropical island where we could find sufficient food and shelter without adding to the change already taking place. We human beings deliberately change our environment to survive. You might say that our role in nature is a little bit more like beavers than vultures. We're part of nature, and it's our nature to change nature. Now, by that, I'm not trying to be anthropocentric, as if it's all just about us. Rather, what I would like to try to be is theocentric, that it's about God, about our Lord and what our God, the Creator, is doing. Creation's not about us. It's ultimately about God, particularly as revealed God's self in the person and work of Jesus Christ. As T.S. Eliot put it, Jesus Christ is the still point of the turning world. Or C.S. Lewis, I do not believe in the sun just because I see it, but also because by its light I see everything else. And I'm also convinced of Jesus Christ as the one who makes sense of everything else, including nature. Do you remember this banner from McMaster University, our annual meeting just a few years ago? This banner is part of the seal from when the university was founded. It's a provincial Canadian research number one university. But it does have built into its seal this phrase from Colossians 1:17. Would you read it for us?
In Christ, all things hold together?
Yes. All things in Christ hold together. That Christ is the center point, that which makes sense of and holds together all of God's creation. So I want to be clear that I would argue that in my understanding of the Christian tradition, the world is not God, but this is God's world. And this favorite text, John 3:16, is for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Cal DeWitt pointed out to me at our annual meeting in Seattle quite a few years ago that this famous text does not just say that God loves people, that this text says that God loves all of his creation, hakosmos, the whole world. But within that creation, God has for human beings a particular unique role to play. That we're the only ones described as having been created in God's own image, Genesis 1, 26 and 27. The image of God has been described by different people who've thought about it very carefully in three primary ways that I'm sure you're aware of. One is the idea of capacity, another is the idea of relationship with God, and then particular mandate or call. So let's talk about each of those for just a few minutes because it so deeply affects how we relate to the rest of creation. Washu the chimp may know 100 signs in sign language, but that's qualitatively different from reading Wittgenstein or even more than from writing a paper critiquing Wittgenstein. We have a great deal in common with all other living creatures. We're very much of this world. But I would argue that in human beings, there is a whole series of quantitative changes that become emergent phenomena that are qualitative, that make us distinct by God's grace and creation. There are some animals that have the ability to sense the difference between dark and light, but that can progress quantitatively to an emergent property of seeing line and image. That can progress quantitatively to a new emergent phenomenon of creating and composing color in the works of Monet. Human beings are of the same stuff as the rest of life, but qualitatively as different in some emergent properties from other animals as a bacterium is from a rock. We are still from dust, and to dust we shall return. But what is emergent becomes an all-important and unique capacity, particularly the capacity to be able to know God and to know that we know God. That's uniquely human. Now, the claim is not that we know God in every detail and with perfection. God is so far beyond what we can fully comprehend. I think of a story the medievals used to tell about Augustine that we can't find in Augustine's own writings. So it's hard to know exactly when the story started, but I think it rings true. The story is that Augustine was walking along a beach and saw a young child that was dashing down the sand into the surf and filling a bowl with water and running up the beach and pouring the water in a hole. And that he stopped at a non-threatening distance and said, "Excuse me, but what are you doing?" And the child held up her bowl very proudly and she said, "Today I'm going to empty the ocean with my bowl." She knew what that surf felt like tugging against her ankles. She knew the taste of salt water on her tongue. She could hear the roar of the surf. She could see that blue water. She could truly comprehend and experience and know the ocean with every sense she had. But she couldn't begin to comprehend that that blue water stretched across an ocean to other continents, that there were dolphins and whales and stingrays and sharks, that they were underground, underwater canyons and mountains. She could truly experience the water, the ocean, with every sense she had. She did know the ocean, but she couldn't begin to comprehend fully what it was she was experiencing. And the description would be that that's our relationship with God. We can truly know God. We can truly experience God with everything we've got. But part of what we begin to realize is that God is so far beyond our comprehension. There's so much more to who God is than what we can imagine. But someday we shall understand as fully as we've been understood. So that relationship is unique to human beings and central to who it is and what it means to carry God's image, to be in relationship with God. Maybe you'd like the way Calvin put it, where he said that a mirror can't reflect an image unless it's in relationship with what it's reflecting. So the image of God has to do with a capacity and with a relationship with God. And that it has to do with a calling. As God shapes and develops God's creation, we're tasked with doing so as well as God's representatives in God's image. Remember, in Genesis, it doesn't say that God placed human beings in a wilderness to pass through. It says that he placed them in a garden. One shapes a garden. One makes choices that make a difference in a garden. A garden requires choices. One can't encourage the roses without restraining the aphids. It's a choice. It's a choice that makes a difference. Now, it's still God's garden. We tend it as God's representatives. And granted, God could do it better without us. But welcome sharing that life with us and who we become in sharing that life with us. So you get the very direct mandate in Genesis 2:15 that we are to till and to keep the garden. Now, this is often misunderstood. That word till, its immediate context is most important, but to give you an example how it's used in other places, that word till is what's used in Joshua 24:15, where it says, "As for me and my house, we will till the Lord." Okay. Till has an idea of to serve, not to render to harm. That word that we will keep the garden is the same word that Aaron uses in Numbers 6:24 when he gives his blessing to Moses and says, "May the good Lord bless and keep you." Adam is to serve and to bless God's garden. So as we care for the garden, what is does not necessarily tell us what should be. Remember the roses and the aphids. They're genuine choices. We are to care for it and to develop ourselves and the rest of creation. Now, the only one who has perfectly lived God's image is Jesus Christ. How did he spend most of his earthly life? I mean, just in sheer number of hours. Well, you might guess sleep. That might have been roughly a third. But chances are it seems he spent most of his life as the town builder, where he was, by God's grace and perfectly in God's image, shaping creation into plows and door frames and shelter out of love for God and his neighbors. And Jesus taught that we too should develop the world entrusted to us. Do you remember in Matthew chapter 24, where he says that there's going to be a terrible trying time, that he will lose his life, but he will gain it back. He'll also then later return. And the disciples naturally ask, when? And in Matthew chapter 25, he begins by telling the story of the young women who are going to the wedding. They didn't bring enough batteries for their flashlights. And so half of them go to Walmart to get more batteries, and they come back. They've missed the wedding. You remember this story, right? Okay. So he warns his disciples that it's going to be quite a while. They're going to have to endure. There's going to be some time that passes. So then they ask the natural question, the next section of Matthew 25. So what should we do if it's going to take some time? And that's when Jesus tells the story of the talents. Having warned his disciples that it would be some time before God's kingdom was fully established, in the meantime, they are to take the resources that they have and that they have been entrusted with, and that they are to multiply them. And you all know the story of the one who had 10 made 10 more, 5 made 5 more. The one who had 1 hid it and is rebuked for having done nothing with what was entrusted to him. To what purpose and in what way should we develop our entrusted resources? That's the third section of Matthew 25. where Jesus tells that it doesn't achieve salvation to care for your neighbor. But if you indeed are part of God's family, it's family business, it's characteristic of family, you will care for your neighbor. So bringing water to the thirsty, healing the sick, caring for the hungry, visiting those in prison, taking their care of those in the hospital, that it's going to take time. You're to multiply your resources, invest to make a difference, and what is the kind of difference you should make in the lives of your neighbors. So in Matthew 25, we have praise for those who were prepared for the long haul, multiplied and trusted resources, and cared for their neighbors. And the text goes on at length to rebuke those who did not. There's approbation for those who did not do what they could, who did not care for their neighbors when they could have helped. So I'm suggesting that part of our calling in the image of God and of Christ is to care for the world that's been entrusted to us. That where we can, we should seek to sustain it. That where we can and there's been damage, we should try to restore it. And that it's appropriate for us to look for ways to improve it. And if that isn't radical enough, would that include our bodies too? Well, what was the sign that mandated to Abraham to show that he and his descendants were the people of God? Does this help? Okay. That's an Ishmael. Okay. This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised as a sign that you are indeed part of God's people. A intentional cutting off of a normal part of the male physical body. Change even in our physical form might be appropriate. It's built right into the identification of the covenant and how you knew you were part of the people of God to have physical change. Now, my mother told me that if I ignored my teeth, they'd go away. And by the way, my mother would want me to be clear, this is not a picture of my mother. So let's give the example of teeth. You brush your teeth to sustain them. You fill cavities to restore them. And in the case of my daughters, who had never experienced a cavity in their life, they received a sealant on their teeth to help their teeth resist cavities. That's an improvement. Sustain, restore, and maybe we might even see some opportunities to improve. So their experience of their teeth has been better than would have been without that deliberate improvement. Now, it can not only be teeth, this can be a matter of life and death. This is smallpox, a vicious, lethal disease that has swept across our planet many times, killing a high percentage of the people who lived in its path. One can, through sufficient rest and diet, seek to sustain your immune system by getting enough sleep, not now. You can help your immune system, maybe antibiotics to restore health when the system is overwhelmed, and vaccination to improve your immune system. I can guess with pretty good assurity here that anybody in this room over 50 has a small round square or scar on your shoulder, and that pretty much everyone in the room under 50 does not. And of course, what is that? That was getting a vaccination against smallpox. Now, there are only two cities in the world left where we know smallpox still exists. What are those two cities? Atlanta, Georgia, and Moscow. Yeah. Why is there still smallpox in Atlanta, Georgia? It's in the CDC, right, yeah. Kept under great security and frozen solid in case anything ever gets loose in the future, we can more quickly respond since we have that available. Okay. But because we have deliberately changed our planet we have deliberately sought to wipe out a species. I think that was to the right and good. I think that was an improvement in the garden that God entrusted to us. Now, that's with fear and trembling. One has to be very careful that you make things better, not worse. I'd argue that that's an example of making it better. Cattle aren't worried about smallpox, but they sure appreciate that we've wiped out rinderpest. Rinderpest was a wild type of organism which regularly killed many cattle around the world, and we made the conscious choice to try to wipe out that species, and we did. I think that was an improvement, all considered. But how do you make decisions like this? What kinds of things should be guiding us if we do? Well, I think in context, the classic Micah 6:8, what does God require of you? That you seek justice, that you love kindness, and that you walk humbly. It's interesting, these particular choices of key things to remember, we find over and over again in ethical literature. You know, whether you call it natural law, or self-evidence, or rational reflection, influential ethicists such as John Rawls, James Childress, and others have come up with very similar lists, just sometimes different terminology. But that it's appropriate and important that we seek justice, fairness, that we love kindness, we seek to benefit and help others, not to harm them, and that we walk humbly, that we realize that we're so finite, we make mistakes so easily, we can be so bent in our choices, that we show great respect and caution and care and direct that to other people. Okay. Well, keeping this in mind, let me be very concrete then. Ethics is supposed to be about, okay, what should we do? I'll suggest four questions that I think we should consider when we're thinking Christianly about what's the right thing to do with CRISPR or any other medical intervention. Number one, is the particular treatment or intervention being proposed safe for those who are involved? Primum non nocere is the classic starting statement for medical ethics. First, do no harm. At least don't make the patient worse. And so it's appropriate that we should think in terms of taking great care that when we do make a conscious choice, and we can't avoid making conscious choices. Well, I mean, we can't avoid making choices. We can be unconscious about it, right? I'm arguing that we need to be conscious and conscientious about our choices. We can't eliminate all risk. We won't be able to get home from the conference risk-free, just not available. But that it's a major concern that we pursue safety for all who are involved. Second, is the treatment or the action with CRISPR, is it a genuine improvement? Are we making the world at least a little bit better in that corner where this event takes place? Is it a genuine improvement? And there are many places where this can create real discussion. You're probably aware of the couple not that long ago in Washington, D.C. that went to get medical help. They wanted to assure that any child they gave birth to would be born deaf. And the question that the medical staff realized was, well, we can do that, but should we? Should we help assure that all of your children are deaf? Should they? Would that be a genuine improvement to make sure a child isn't able to hear? Why would a set of parents ask for only deaf children? That particular couple themselves were deaf, and they decided it was an act of confidence in their way of life and the superiority of deafness that they wanted that for their child as well. It happened to be at Gallaudet, so that's why Washington, D.C. Okay. So, I mean, there's a whole discussion there we could talk about. I think a key question is the proposed treatment indeed a genuine improvement? Does it increase the recipient's choices? This is a way of showing respect for the other person, walking humbly, that you're not trying to determine somebody else's life. That you only make choices that increase their choices, not decrease them. What's the most important choice you can make in your life? That you do make in your life? I think it's if you welcome and receive God's love and grace. That if you turn to God for life, that's the single most important choice you can make. In at least some sense, pretty much all Christian traditions would say that you have a choice at that point of some sort. That if God gives you choice at the most important choice you could ever make, surely we should allow people choice in lesser decisions as much as we can. That we shouldn't use genetics to try to predestine people or to shape them to our purpose. Are there things you can do that increase people's choices? Absolutely. I would argue that being able to hear gives you more choice than if you're not able to hear. If you teach someone to read, you don't require what they will read, but you've opened up whole worlds to them. There are many things you can do that increase people's choices. Is it the best use of always finite resources? This is the question of fairness or justice. That actions affect not just you, but also other people. And is the way resources are being used the most appropriate and fair and just way of using those resources? So I'm suggesting very concretely, not leaving it up in the air, but saying here's some examples of some key questions I think we should ask. But this is always in the context of remembering that changing our received nature could never offer us salvation or utopia. But we can and should tend the garden and help our neighbors. We should sustain and restore and do what we can. Now, you can probably help me with this. A gathering of cows is a herd, of whales is a pod. What's a gathering of crows?
Murder.
Murder of geese?
A gaggle.
Of lions?
A pride.
Of ethicists? I'll propose that a gathering of ethicists is a worry. And it's appropriate to have some worry and to try to think these things through carefully. Let's change course before the damage is worse and try to choose well. I would say that Christian ethics serves an important purpose when it warns of the danger of pride, but it should also warn us of the danger of apathy. It tells us in part what not to do, but it should also remind and encourage us as to what we should do. Christian ethics is neither lawless nor legalist. It's about being set free through and in Christ to live as God created us to live. Ken Untner wrote in honor of Oscar Romero the following, and I'll just read it slowly. I think it's so profound and powerful as a context for this conversation. God's kingdom is not only beyond our efforts, it's even beyond our comprehension. We accomplish in our lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. We plant seeds that will one day grow. We water seeds already planted. We lay foundations that will need further development, add yeast that produces far beyond our capabilities. What we do is but a step along the way, an opportunity for the Lord's grace to enter. We are workers, not the master builder, ministers, not the Messiah. We have a profound part to play, and we're responsible for what we do. So may we do our part prayerfully, thoughtfully, wisely, out of love for God, for one another, and the rest of creation that God has entrusted to us. Now, this is all so much more complex and requires so much more nuance than we could just do in the last few minutes. If you want to see some of these arguments in much more complete detail, this would be one of the places where you could do that. But I wanted to be sure to give you some time. I could give you some cases to test, or if you have particular questions or challenges that you'd like to raise, having been given a brief overview of some of the things that we need to consider. So how do you want, do you have microphones, or you want to call on people, Keith, or how did you want to do this?
Okay, thank you very much.
It's getting a red blink.
Oh, God, that's the batteries again.
Hey, there we go.
There we go, okay.
So, yes, any questions? I'll bring the mic over.
Hi, Sae Kim. Thank you so much for a very enlightening talk. I have two questions, and I don't think there's any particular answer. I'm looking for your perspective from an ethicist and scientist point of view. The first one is in the case of diversity, like sickle cell, which gives benefits to diseases like malaria, the use of CRISPR or any genetic engineering mechanisms, and their impact on potential future diseases, and what if we get rid of a diversity genetic defect, but it actually ends up being benefit for future unknown diseases as of yet? And then the second question is, in the context of where I work at AAAS, there's been some symposia and at NAS and AAAS where I've heard discussions where it's great that there's all this engagement with faith leaders and theologians, and I give very much commendation to the scientific community for doing that. But at the same time, there's a sense of the fact that the reality is that these kind of engineerings is going to happen and in ways that we are not necessarily comfortable with. So are there actionable things that we can do to ensure that it is protected and it is regulated, because we know it's going to happen whether we discuss it or not? So thank you.
Okay, lots there that's very worth discussing. Okay, the first one about sickle cell is such an interesting example. Why does sickle cell continue if it's always deleterious? It may be that if you're a carrier for it, if you don't have the actual disease, there's an advantage. And it appears that people who are carriers for sickle cell, not having the disease, but carriers for it, so they have one copy, not two, have a better survival rate with malaria. So in parts of the world where we have a lot of malaria as a major test on your health, it can actually be advantageous to be a carrier for sickle cell. Even though if you give birth to a child with your spouse and they inherit sickle cell from both parents, it can be debilitating, even deadly. So another example would be, it appears, this hasn't been nailed down yet, but it looks like cystic fibrosis, if you're a carrier, helps resistance against cholera, which might explain why it's the most widespread genetic disease among Caucasians from cholera experience in Europe in the past. So this raises a very basic, important question, and that is, when I say that it needs to be safe and not harm the recipient, you can't just think immediately, you have to think longer term, and that there are these kinds of add-on effects that need to be considered. I don't think we're ever going to regret wiping out smallpox. But are there some conditions where there's a cost up front, but it's actually worth it? That might very well be. So that has to be part of the addressing and thinking it through. Well taken. As far as what can we do concretely, there are all kinds of mechanisms where you can speak. We do live in a democracy, and so we each have just a tiny piece of our democracy, but we are at least in theory supposed to be in charge. And so we're responsible to each do what we can in terms of the larger system, and also to do like we're doing here, where we build mediating institutions. It's a terrible mistake to think that the government is the only thing we do together. So much of what we need to do is in schools and in hospitals and in churches and in associations like ASA, that we can multiply our efforts, our knowledge, our understanding, and our input through mediating institutions like this one. And so I don't think that all is lost. I think we can have an influence and an impact. So the first question is, what am I going to do? Then what is my family going to do? Then what is my church community, with all the resources and leading of God's Spirit, what should we do? And just keep building these circles and seek to have as positive an influence as we can. Now, granted the observation that there are people who will use this kind of technology in very destructive and harmful ways, we can try to ameliorate that we can't guarantee that it will not be used in a harmful way. Do you remember I showed you that slide right at the beginning, that there are labs that will provide you with CRISPR materials free of charge to get you interested in working with them? Right? This is a technology sort of like when personal computers started appearing in people's garages, where it takes relatively small sums of money, and if you're dealing with something more complicated than bacteria, it takes more education. But there will be a phenomenal number of people who are able to manipulate CRISPR. The most chilling slide that we saw at this meeting was from a professor at Stanford who specialized in defense issues, where he showed the head of the physics department at Mosul University, who was beheaded by ISIS because he would not help them build a bomb. There was also a full genetics department at Mosul University. And we don't know to what degree ISIS got hands on any of this technology at that point, but will people who mean harm get a hold of some of this technology? We can do the best we can. I think that's going to be an issue. So we need to be prepared to deal with it when it arises. So like any power, it can be used in a positive or harmful way. We need to think about what are the positive ways we can use it and how can we defend as best we can against harmful uses. So both points well taken.
Time for a couple more questions. I'm wondering if the debate about genetically modified seeds for agriculture, there might be some parallels that might happen about CRISPR. You know, in case of GEM, it's pretty well accepted in the United States, but then there are countries in Europe that absolutely pretty well outlaw. So there might be something like that with CRISPR.
Yeah, I've been focusing on thinking about CRISPR related to human beings, but it affects everything that's alive. So can CRISPR be used to affect seeds and agriculture and other animals? Absolutely. When you come from different contexts, my wife and kids and I happened to be at Oxford during the period when they had mad cow disease in England. And that's when the population of England learned that they couldn't trust the food in restaurants or grocery stores. And so there's this deep-seated experience that you have to be suspicious of what agriculture and big business provides for your food. And I think that's carried right on over into GMO foods. Whereas in the United States, we didn't really have that experience directly, and people tended to be much more trusting about Quaker oats will get it right. And so it's been much more accepted, and so far so good. So it seems like we haven't had any mass casualties from GMOs. But this whole societal experience of how do you perceive threat, how much do you trust various branches of society, does it apply to our food too? Very much so. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, thanks, first of all, Jim, for your presentation. It was very well done, and I appreciate the insights. You're contrasting a very beneficial thing when we're talking about health as opposed to something that can be destructive. What about something in the middle, like creating tall basketball players? Would you comment about that?
Okay, sure. Yeah, I mean, a parent who wants their kid to be 7 feet tall, it's actually not a new question. We went through this in detail with human growth hormone, which was already a medical technical way to pursue that kind of a goal. I would want to ask very immediately, is that actually safe for the child? Is it an actual benefit? They might be able to play basketball together, but that's not necessarily if they want to be a gymnast or do something else. Is that an actual improvement? And then also, is that decreasing their autonomy, their choice? Are you taking away future choices by giving them a frame that's not going to fit in most normal circumstances? So I'd argue that that example, and it's a very interesting one, would actually fail several of the questions that I think we need to ask. Are there other ones that are even more complicated? Certainly, yes. So again, we just had time. I'm just getting you started on what's out there and what needs to be done. I realize there's so much more to discuss.
Thank you very much. Okay.